Welcome back. We will now hear Jeff Leeton, who is with Red Hat and also a Zampa team member, and he will talk about the benefits of Kerberos authentication.
Hi, everybody. This talk is about using Kerberos authentication with the Linux kernel SIPS client. We added support for this probably 2 years ago, about a year and a half ago, and it's just recently had the experimental tag taken off of it. Usually when you build a kernel, for a while, as we add new features, we tag it as experimental, but that's recently been lifted now. And so this talk is about using the actual authentication, or using Kerberos with it. So who am I? I'm a member of the file system engineering team at Red Hat since 2006. Just joined the Samba team 6 months ago or so. Mostly I work on SIFS and NFS, but also work some in sort of generic BFS type problems, VM problems sometimes. And I wrote most of the in-kernel parts of the KRB5 upcall mechanism, which we'll get to in a little bit. So here's basically what we're going to talk about today. Basic Kerberos, it's configuring a machine to actually do SIFS with KRB5. Then problems with the current implementation, deployment scenarios. This not so much problems with the Kerberos implementation itself, but problems with deploying it in a multi-user fashion. I ran across a lot of these as I was preparing for this talk, so we've got some more work to do here. And then this will also be future improvements. So here's a little bit about Kerberos in general. It was invented at MIT, first publication in the 1980s, V4. And then V5 was published in 1993, so it's been around for quite a while. Almost all Unix-like operating systems have it in some form or fashion. And Microsoft adopted it as the basis of Active Directory authentication. So this is really one of the main reasons why we care. You know, I mean, we would like to be able to authenticate in an Active Directory environment. And also Samba as well, you know, when it works in Active Directory mode. I'm not sure which, you know, what they actually call it all the time, but Samba also will do KRB5. So what is it? Kerberos is secure authentication over insecure networks. The idea is that you have machines that are trusted or semi-trusted, and the network between them is not. So the idea is that you have, it's a way for people and machines and services within the realm, which is somewhat like a domain, to verify their identity to one another, but without ever sending the password across the network. So it relies on a trusted third party, the KDC, that actually has the password or a hash of the password, actually. All the entities in the Kerberos database are considered principals to the KDC. So it will, so whether you're a user or whether it's a service principal, which we'll talk about in a little bit, it makes no difference to the KDC. It's all just they're all called principals, or they're all considered to be the same thing. And the authentication is mutual. So while you this allows a person to verify their identity with a service, it allows the reverse as well. So you know, someone on the other side can say, you know, wait, you know, this someone's trying to do a man-in-the-middle attack. So here's sort of how it works. It's a little bit more complex than this, but this is sort of a basic idea. The idea is that you have a client here, and he's talking to the KDC, and he wants to talk to the SIFS server over here. So he talks to the KDC and gets a ticket granting ticket first. Now, how that happens is a little complex, but not terribly so. But it's essentially you send some info to the server that's encrypted with a password that you have, and then the server will send back some stuff also encrypted with your password. And then you can use your password to decrypt that. And if all that works, then you can take the ticket granted ticket and get a service ticket. And then that would be the service ticket to talk to the SIFS server. And then you use that service ticket to talk to the SIFS server. So here's, put this in here, I'm not sure why. Anyway, this is what a Kerberos principal usually looks like in its fully qualified form. You have a primary, and then an instance, and then there's the realm. The primary is sort of the username or service name. Instance is an additional qualifier. Sometimes you see username/admin, which kind of denotes a ticket that's gives you extra privileges. Often the instance will be, for service tickets, will be the fully qualified domain name of the host. And the realm is sort of like a domain concept under Windows. I mean, you have all the machines and users are unique within the realm. So here's some examples. Here's the user principal, jlatenexample.com. And there's an admin one. And then here's service principles. So when I want to talk to a service principal, what I have to do is get a service ticket for one of these services. When I want to talk to the SIF server, I get a SIF set /server example.com at example.com. So here's some more alphabet soup. GSS API and Spinego. It's not quite as simple as using Kerberos. You have to Kerberos. What they found over time was that using Kerberos is pretty complex and not very well standardized. So everybody, all applications that were using Kerberos in a lot of ways had to write sort of their own scheme for using it. So they wrote this. So I guess back in the late 90s, this GSS API standard was created, which basically gives you a programmatic interface for doing Kerberos authentication or for other mechanisms as well. So it's sort of a standard plug-in mechanism for plugging in authentication schemes. And then on top of that, there's also Spinego, which is a mechanism by which the server and client can negotiate an authentication mechanism to use. This is important because this is what when a SIFS client wants to talk to a SIFS server, they do a Spinego negotiation to figure out which authentication scheme they should use.
Well, at least appropriate
use of
the word simple.
Simple, yes. Well, actually, I mean, once you get past this, Spinego is really not that hard. It's just a list of mechanisms, so it's really not too tough. But getting there is a little trickier. So anyway, here's the basically it works. Basic SIFS authentication. The client sends a negotiate protocol request to the server. I mean, a lot of you guys will be familiar with this, but and it sets the extended security bit, and that tells the server that it should that you basically want to do this Spinego negotiation to figure it out, to figure out what security mechanism to use. Server sends back a list of the auth methods that it uses in order of preference. And then the client sends a session setup packet with a Spinego blob with a KRB5 ticket wrapped up in it. And then at that point, the server should send back an ACK that you're authenticated. And then you can tree connect and do all that sort of stuff. So here's a little diagram that shows basically how we implement this in the kernel client. mount.sif, someone requests a KRB5 mount, basically, and we'll show how to do that here in just a little bit. But so anyway, we talk to we request a KRB5 mount that talks to the kernel, which you're talking to the sifs.ko kernel module at that point. Well, sort of a little more complex than that. We go through the BFS layer. But anyway, this is sort of a simplified diagram. The SIFS module then will talk to the keys API, which is a mechanism for managing keys or security blobs sort of within the kernel. It was invented by Dave Howells for use with AFS mostly, but it's a generic service that any file system in the kernel can hook into. So that's what we use. The keys API will then call out to a request key program that lives on the box, or that should be in SBIN usually. And then request key will call into SIFS upcall, and that will wrap up a that will find the Kerberos ticket that you want, wrap it up in the Spinego blob, and feed it back to the kernel, so it all goes. So after that, it will all go back into the kernel, and then the mount should proceed. I forgot to mention, I mean, if anybody has questions here, be sure just to raise your hand, and I'll call on you. There's no need to wait till the end. So what do you need for this? You need a Linux kernel that supports Spinego upcalls, and you got to configure it for it, of course. There's a configuration option for, I think it's config sys upcall. Support first went into mainline in 2.6.24. So you know, any kernel later than that that's properly configured should be fine. Though there were bugs in some of the earlier ones, of course. Later the better. Client configure, you need the client configured for KRB5, so you need to be able to get tickets, of course. That's a little beyond the scope of this talk, but we'll just take that as a requirement. You need SBIN request key, which is usually part of the key utils package. That's another, the user space piece of that of the keys API. So there's some libraries and a couple programs that sit in there. And then you need user SBIN sys upcall, or you know, you can put it wherever you want, but I mean, essentially it's part of the Samba package. When you build mount sys, usually you get this as part of it if you've got you know the right configuration options turned on. For a while we called it sys Spinego, but we extended this actually to let us do DFS name resolution as well. So this is also the mechanism by which we do that. So because of that, we renamed it to something more generic, which is sysupcall. So in order to configure, so when the kernel calls out to request key, request key needs to know what to do. So there's a config file called etc request key conf that you have to configure. So you set this up, and essentially the line looks like this. You know, it's pretty straightforward. This is the operation. We want to create a new key blob. There's the type of key is what's sent by the kernel. The kernel says, I want a sys Spinego key. And I can't remember what these guys do, but they're not terribly important. This is the program it needs to run, and then what args it has. And the percent %k is the key ID that the kernel sends for the authorization key. The way the keys API works is a little complex, but it's fairly secure. So, but it does some stuff with not just anybody can forcibly send the wrong key into the kernel. Well, there should be a pound here too. By the way, this is wrong. Oh, by the way, this is also the way you can set up DFS if you're interested in that. Basically, all you need to make DFS or be able to chase DFS referrals is set this DNS resolver line here. So if you have that, then your DFS referrals should just basically work in any recent kernel. Oh, so yeah, I was going to get back. Sure, sure.
Does the percent %k thread through the calls? Is that asking for DNS names involving odd things? Or?
I'm sorry, what now?
I was looking at the macro substitution there. Is that protected in some way? Is
the macro substitution on that sys up call protected in some way to stop silly buggers? You know, being sent, like you could be sent to a DNS name or something really quite weird, or?
No, I mean, you could, if the kernel calls out and wants this weird DNS name, you know, it will just try to resolve it.
So, yeah.
So I'm not, I guess I don't quite understand the question.
Okay. So what's going in the variable
right.
Is coming from the kernel. So at that point, it should have already gone through all branch
developers. Okay, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, we've already processed the DFS referral at that point and stripped out the host name, and all we're sending here is the host name for it to do this. It was a sort of intended as a generic mechanism for resolving host names in the kernel. So sys is the only user of it, and I think the NFS maintainer, Tron Mecklenburg, is actually working on a different implementation that we may look at later. So we may end up dumping this eventually, but for now, this is the way it works. I keep forgetting. Oh yeah, I was gonna do a demo. So anyway, here's, wait a minute. I think I missed a, I got my slides are out of order. Ah, okay. So here's the way you do a simple mount with Caribee 5. Knit is the way you get a ticket granting ticket. So you know, in this case, root is doing a knit for test user at example.com. He puts in the password for test user, gets the ticket granting ticket, and then just does a mount tsifs sec equals KRB5, and with the UNC and the mount point. So pretty straightforward. Let's see. So we'll go ahead and do that here real quick. So I'm going to knit test user. So do a klist, and you can see I've already got a ticket granting ticket. Now I'm going to so that should work. Yep. So now if you look, if I klist again, you'll see behind the scenes what happens is I ended up getting a service ticket. So what happened is the kernel called out to sysup call. It got the service ticket for the sys service on my local box. Actually, I'm just doing this on a local Samba server. And then after that, I have a mount. So here it is, it's mounted. Now the catch is we don't currently reverse resolve the name that we use to call out to that we use to do the mount. So whatever name you put in here is what ends up being what the upcall ends up wanting to use for this field here. So eventually what I want to do is have it we already send the address to the upcall, but what we need to do is reverse resolve that and probably get the canonical host name that way. That's not implemented yet, but it wouldn't be too hard to do. I just haven't found time for it. So anyway, now I've got this mount. I can cd into mount sifs, and if I look in there, I've got some stuff, right? So I'm here. I'm test user. So if I go into the test user if I go into the public directory, let's say, and touch test user. So I end up with a file, right, that's owned by test user. And if I go into a different, isn't as a different user, so here I'm going in as myself. And it says permission denied. So it said setting times permission denied. And you look here and you'll see that it created the file JLayton, but it created it as test user. This is the fundamental problem that we have right now. And I'll go over it here in a minute. So the traditional method for mounting mounting network file systems on Unix is NFS, right? So in NFS, we have two users. They want to write to an NFS mount. The calls go across the wire with their own credentials. So each call, each call to create a file is sent the client sends the user credentials in each call. So nobody really owns the connection to the server. It's just, whoever happens to walk in there, whatever credentials they use. SIFS is not like that. SIFS is a single user protocol. So the problem is here, even though we have a mount to the server, and even though we've got POSIX extensions enabled, and we can see modes and ownership and things like that, you are still authenticated using that single credential. So, this is one of the things that we would like to maybe change eventually. It's not like that today, or it's right now we can't really do proper multi-user mounts. So I'm gonna Now I'm going to sidestep even a little further and talk about POSIX extensions. So SIFS will enable POSIX extensions by default when the server supports it. So we have problems because of the single user nature of this of the mounts. You have some problems with modes and ownership. Not just because of that, but there's a general problem of the UID and GID may just not match on client and server, right? So if I walk into this directory, and it looks like I see a file that's that looks like it's owned by me. It may not actually be owned by me on the server, you know, if the UIDs don't match. There's another problem too. The current SIFS client will override ownership, but not the mode, when the UID or GID options are specified. So usually when you go to mount as a user, which we'll do here in a little bit, the UID, the mount program will pass the UID and GID options to the mount SIFS program. So what you end up with is this file that is owned, it looks like it's owned by whoever, you know, whatever UID or GID owns the mount. But the modes are still the same. So now you have permissions that just have no bearing in reality at all. So that's a bit of a problem. And I'm working on I've got a patch that should fix that, but I'm trying to convince the maintainer upstream to take it. So, and all the options on the server are done using the mount credentials, but the VFS will enforce these permissions locally. That's the problem we saw here. So when I did this, I did this touch, and I got setting of times of permission denied, but it did create the file. So what happened was we created the file as test user, but now the VFS says, oh, this file is owned by test user, you can't go change the time on it. So that's the reasoning for that error. So we have sort of a half-assed way to work around this. We have this thing called multi-user mount. You can enable it by, I think, echoing one into here or something. And essentially, the idea is that when you have multiple mounts that are owned by different users, or they're owned by different UIDs, if I walk into any of these directories, we'll just pretend that that we're using this other mount. So say I've got, a mount as myself, I've got a mount as test user, I walk into test user's mount, but we're going to use my credentials because the kernel can tell that my UID is actually the same one as this one. There are problems with this approach. First, it requires a separate mount for each user, which is pretty cumbersome. Users that don't have their own mount still use the default credentials, which just seems wrong. And then we have other problems with permissions and file ownership, and there's some problems with write back that I don't want to dig into too deeply. But essentially, it's not really a good solution, in my opinion. So in case you haven't guessed, my talk is kind of like turning out like Dirk's was a keynote, where he said he walked in he's got more questions than answers. So that's kind of where I'm leading here. We have this mechanism that sort of works. But there are associated problems with trying to do this in a way that I think is correct. Obviously, we don't want to share Kerberos tickets between users. I mean, that sort of violates the whole principle behind the thing. So what we need is a good way to do this. So for now, I mean, we don't really have a good mechanism for this. So one of the things you can do is limit permissions to the user who owns the creds. So what you can do is, try to enforce this on the server, maybe. Only this user, has these mounts. So limit the mode on the top level directory so that nobody can walk into this directory unless they actually have the right credentials. And maybe disable Unix extensions altogether and just put restrictive modes on everything. I kind of hate to recommend that, but unfortunately, the POSIX extensions, the way we are currently have them implemented by SIFS, are not as useful as I think they should be. But, so there's some other mechanisms. I mean, you can do some other, try to deploy this in other ways. You can do user mounts in etcfs tab, right? So we could say, let's say we're going to do this thing where we want each user to mount their own share. So if you have a bin mount and the mount helper or set UID root, mount helper is mount.sifs, and the user owns the mount point, and you've got you've got the mount listed in etcfs tab with the user option, which is to be contrasted from the user equals option, which is how you specify the username if you wanted to use normal username password auth. So we've got, so here's sort of an example. So you can start with something like this, right? So here I've done, you know, sec equals caribv5 user, turning off Unix extensions so I don't have to worry about the modes getting screwed up. File mode, dir mode 700 so that nobody else can walk in there, no auto. So then you can do this as an unprivileged user. So, and that should work. I'm going to skip doing the example on that because we're running out of time. Another possibility, you can use AutoFS. AutoFS works with SIFS, even with caribv5. I've tested this and it does work. AutoFS seems to do funny things with double forward slashes, so I actually had to use the double backslash notation here for the UNC. But anyway, that works too. But the problem here is that how do you ensure that the right user gets this mount, right? You know, so, say if test user were to walk into this directory, then you have a problem, right? You can't you know, as long as he's got permissions to actually go in there on the server. Then he could just take over the directory when you really intended it for me. So that's not a great solution either. And there's another one, PAM mount. PAM mount is a mechanism where you can mount file systems at login, or authentication time, I suppose. So user can, and you can actually set it up so that you can, that users can configure their own set of mounts. So you can say PAM mount, we'll look at this file whenever a user logs in to go and figure out what mounts it should mount. It's most useful when you combine this with PAM caribv5. But the problem is that PAM mount or PAM caribv5 puts the credentials cache in sort of a non-default spot, and SysUpCall doesn't know how to find it. So I've got some patches that I've proposed to remedy this, but they're not in yet. There's another mechanism too, PAM SIFS, that I didn't get around to actually looking at. It seems similar to PAM mount, but it's pretty specific to SIFS. I think the main feature seems to be that you can do some LDAP integration. I think probably a better solution would be if the PAM SIFS maintainer would move that integration in with PAM mount. Does anybody ever use PAM SIFS? I don't know if you have. Oh, okay. Is there anything else, any other compelling reason to use it other than LDAP? Okay. Oh, maybe we should get the microphone back there. Sorry.
So the question was, for the other slide where you just demonstrated that PAM mount would just allow to do these kind of mounts as well, you could just use PAM winmine to get a more default Kerberos credential cache location, because that's also Kerberized by itself.
Oh, okay.
So yeah,
okay.
It's kind of a new feature, but it's nicely documented.
Okay, maybe we should look at that, because I may talk with you offline after this. So. The solution I've proposed for fixing this actually is to pass the cred cache in when you do the mount. So whenever mount SIFS is called, it will grab the cred cache out of the environment variable, send it to the kernel. Kernel then sends it to the upcall, and then the upcall will know how to find it. So here's some near-term improvements that I'm going to try to get in to hopefully fix some of this. Want to tighten up default permissions on mounts without POSIX extensions. Right now, they are pretty much world writable by default, and I think that's not ideal. We've got a patch proposed for that. That's already been posted. So don't want to forcibly override the UID and GID when POSIX extensions are enabled. So when, like I said, when you do this user mount, if you leave POSIX extensions enabled, you end up with modes, but now the ownership looks like it's your own. And I think that's sort of wrong, because you can't really divorce the mode from the ownership that way. I mean, if I say, you know, this UID has these permissions, then if I go and just replace that UID with an arbitrary one, then the whole meaning of the permissions have changed. I want to add in support for non-default credential caches. I've got a patch upstream. I'm not convinced it's the best way to do it yet, but I've not had any comments on it, so I may go ahead and take it. And we want to do reverse name resolution support for getting host principles. Right now, we don't have those yet. So some future directions too. These are a little bit more complex. One idea is to do unprivileged mounts. There are some patches that have been proposed over the last couple of years by Miklos Reddy. Yes. Oh, thank you. So he has some patches for this. They've been through several iterations on some of the Linux mailing lists, but they're not in yet. And I think there's maybe some fundamental problems to make that very difficult to do. Private namespace mounts, there is support for that in kernel now, where you can sort of say, well, this session and this group of processes has this mount, but it only exists within their private namespace. But it's a little tough, because if you've got, say you were to do this at mount time, or at login time, and then all the descendant processes see this mount, but then all of a sudden someone SSHs in, they may not see the same exact mount, and so that's sort of problematic. This one's probably the most promising, but it's a little tricky. We could do multi-session sys mounts. So essentially what we would do is we'd establish a session set up a session on the fly. So whenever a new user walks in, we would do an upcall and basically do a transparent mount in the background, and then let that person use their credentials. It's a little tricky because the way the ownership works, especially when POSIX extensions are turned off. So right now, when POSIX extensions are on, we could just sort of say, well, we'll just assume that this client and server are using the same user IDs and GIDs. But when those are off, then all of a sudden we don't really have any ownership info. So we have to have some mechanism to say who owns this inode when we look at it. And so so now you don't want that to necessarily be the first person that happened to touch that inode. So we have to have some way to swap inode numbers on there. I think I know of a way to do that, but I haven't sat down to really research it yet. And here's my plea for help. Really, I kind of need some input from people that are looking to use this stuff. I mean, I can sit down and try to figure out the best way to do it, but it's not necessarily the case. Does anybody have an opinion? Simo.
Yeah, we had a lot of discussions around this. I think the latest one is the right one, at least long term, just because it makes sense. It requires an ID mapper for the kernel, for sure, for when POSIX extensions are not enabled, and even when POSIX extensions are enabled, but the other server doesn't have the same understanding of UIDs and GIDs. But I think it's the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, ID mapping is sort of a different problem, actually. We can do this without ID mapping if we make the assumption that the client and server are using the same mapping for user IDs and GIDs. If not, if we want to, but that's, so we, if they're not using that same mapping, we need some sort of way to map them correctly. But that's really sort of a separate problem.
Yes, sorry, second question. So the question would be, why don't you just let the server decide whether the user has access or not? Because I know that you do some checking in the client, And that seems a bit wrong at times.
Yeah, that's one of the things I'm looking at. We probably could just sort of schlep that off onto the server. The problem is, though, I mean, even if you do that, you need a way to report. You know, some app may look at permissions and then say, oh, I don't have permissions to touch this file, you know, and fail before you even get to trying it. So true.
So that's pretty rare. I mean, the real philosophy on Unix is to try, don't observe the permissions, try them and deal with the failure. And we haven't had it, everything go to mush when we went to POSIX ACLs. So
yeah,
I think
yeah.
It's entirely, and most apps don't go through and parse a POSIX ACL. So I think it's entirely reasonable to just let the server do all the permission checking.
Maybe you're right. You know, that may be the right answer. So anyway, I'm hoping we can kind of foster some discussion on the Linux SIFS client mailing list. This is the main mailing list we use for development. Incidentally, if anybody's interested in maybe starting in their career in kernel development, we could use some help. So, but in any case, any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Since you were so much on time, we have 10 minutes now before the next talk starts for you to provide yourself with some coffee or some candy.
Wow, that worked out just right.